Welcome to another episode of our podcast, the official Retro Achievement Podcast. I am your host, Draco655, joining by my co-hosts, Shuzi and Bendy Human. How are you guys today?
Doing good, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, hey, I'm in a pretty good zone today. I'm excited to do this.
Today we have a brand new segment for you guys, where we will talk about some what's new on Ori. We will also be discussing what we have played this week, sharing our thoughts on fighting games, and concluding with a conversation about Gaizen walkthrough. Let's get started with a new segment, let's all over by Bendy for this one.
Thank you, Draco. So what's new on RA is basically a segment that's all about exactly what it sounds like. What's new on RA? So without further ado, let's jump right into it. I'd like to get started by briefly going over our recent set releases. Today, we'll be focusing on the sets released from the dates Sunday, September 6th through Saturday, September 12th, starting with Mega Man ZX on the DS by GameZone, Super Mario 4 on the Game Boy. This is an unlicensed game by Supercool 101. The Little Mermaid 2 Pinball Frenzy on Game Boy Color by Suffa 28. The bonus set for Super Mario Brothers on NES by Kisume Buckets. Metal Gear Solid Integral on PlayStation by Willite Warrior. Bad Dudes vs. Dragon Ninja on arcade by Wimpy. Art of Fighting 2 on arcade by Felipe. The Yoshi Garden, my personal favorite from this list, a Nintendo 64 hack by Spory Tyke. Pocky and Rocky 2 on SNES by Elena. Colin McRae Rally on PlayStation by Vouts. The Legend of Banjo-Kazooie, The Jiggies of Time. This is a hack on Nintendo 64 by Kaiser Lucas. We have also Russian Attack, also known as Green Beret, on the arcade by Wimpy. Dicing Knight on the Wonderswan by the Anxiety Buster. Another hack, Super LSG World on SNES by Vinicius Combat. Prehistoric Man on Super Nintendo by Snowpin. Super Turrican on NES by Bardis1989. Rugrats Search for Reptar on PlayStation by Flawstruck. Fatty Bear's Fun Pack on the 3DO by Matty Kitty TV. Rygar Legendary Warrior on the Lynx by Wimpy. Another Game Boy Color hack, Tohomon by Kisume Buckets. Pardon my Japanese, I'm going to do my best with this next one. Osu Tateke Windon on the DS by Lord Psycho. And Legend of Iowa, a ROM hack of Legend of Zelda on the NES by Monkey Tongue. In other news, the LibRetro build bot has been restored. This comes as great news following our discussion with Melu a few weeks ago. And this means that the core updater and your RetroArch and RA LibRetro emulator should be working again. In addition, on the topic of RA LibRetro, RA LibRetro 1.3.3 has been released. I feel like this announcement kind of went under the radar for a lot of people, but this is significant because it adds support for the Magnavox Odyssey 2, which is pretty exciting. It's always nice to see something new like that on RA, so I'm excited to see what people do with that. We also have the newest issue of RA News is now live. Issue number 2 of the monthly Retro Achievements online magazine can be found by a link on the front page of the RA website. This week also sees the publication of the Retro Achievements Manifesto. This has been added to the official RA documentation. It's basically a document serving to expand on the previously existing FAQs of the website and thoroughly answer the question, what is retroachievements.org? Finally, to conclude this segment, I just want to remind you guys that we have a lot of site events going on right now. We have the Bad Idea Game, Master of the Month, Simple Monthly Master, Achievement of the Week, The Unwanted, Retro Points Master, The Big Achievement. If you guys haven't participated in site events, they're a ton of fun. You could head on over to the competition section of the RA forums, and that should have all the information you need to get started. That's all I have for what's new on RA. Back to you, Draco.
Thank you, Bendy, for the awesome new segment with the RA news. So let's jump into the what we have played this week. So let's start with Shoot. What is your first game you want to mention you have played this week, and how was your week?
My week was pretty good, actually. I've been still kind of focusing a lot on fighters, and the first game I wanted to talk about is Clay Fighters 2 by Hershon. That was a really, really fun fighting game, and I've never played either of the games in the Clay Fighters series before. I think one of my favorite things about this set in particular is how creative some of the achievements are. And obviously, we'll dive a little bit more into fighting games later on when we have a segment about it. But with Clay Fighters 2, some examples of some of these really unique achievements would be there's a character that's a kangaroo called Hoppy, and the achievement is to win a fight while never staying on the ground longer than a second. There are some really unique combo achievements, and then just a lot of different special things that you had to do. Like for another fun achievement was for projectiles, destroying three projectiles. So shooting your projectile at the same time that the enemy shoots theirs, and destroying three of their projectiles. So there was just a lot of really interesting, fun, and unique achievements. And a lot of the times with fighting sets, they're broken down pretty standard to, beat the game with each different fighter. So it was nice to see some, rather than just specific difficulty or complete the game with each fighter, to see some really interesting achievements thrown into the mix. And also the art style was very different from any fighting game that I've really played. Everything is done through claymation or whatever. So it was pretty interesting to do a fighting game with like an art style that I'm not too familiar with, but it still had all of the basic underlying principles of most fighting games, low weak attack, medium attack, and then heavy attack for both kicks and for punches. So it's kind of interesting to learn more about the series and how to play it. And I think that's all I have to really say about that one. So moving on to Draco, and tell us a little bit about what you played this week.
Interesting first game shoot there. For me, my week, like I'm still working into that one game. I want to speak about Darkstone. Actually, this game it took me quite a long time, quite a long, and still maybe I'm the half of the set done right now. By so this is a made by Lotus Magnimus. So pretty much Darkstone, if people don't know, is a game on PlayStation 1. And it's pretty much, I would say, like majority of the game, it's pretty much like Diablo 1. So you have novice, expert, master, and legend as difficulty. The more you level up, the more you can change up different difficulty. And the more stats you have will dependent into the gear you can build. Almost like exactly as Diablo 1, they have some spell as well. You have quests to do, so you have three quests per area, and then every time you can just complete one quest, and you need to collect like seven crystal before defeating the last bosses. And then that's pretty much Darkstone. I mean, this Darkstone is a pretty wonderful game. I'm very surprised how it goes. I really like the artwork and the style of the game, and I really enjoy Diablo as one. So if you really like Diablo, I suggest you to play that game. So it's a very wonderful time. So Bendy, do you have like a game in mind?
Yeah, I do. First, I just wanted to say, I've really enjoyed watching you through your Darkstone grind. I know that's one of those games that it really is quite a grind, but that's a pretty good feeling when you have a game on RA where you could just be like, all right, I'm gonna sink in a huge time commitment to try to master this one game. As far as what I've played recently, though, I've been kind of focusing on the opposite mentality. Rather than focusing a bunch on any singular game, I've been casting a pretty wide net, playing a ton of different games and focusing on gathering badges, just trying to get more and more badges. So kind of focusing on short games. The first one I wanted to talk about is Mario Paint on the Super Nintendo by SporyTike. I feel like Mario Paint is one of those games that needs no introduction. You know, it's the classic creative studio. It's got the music maker. It's got the art component. It has the fly swatter minigame. But the thing is, a lot of people have really fond memories of Mario Paint, and I didn't grow up with this game. So I guess I never really understood what the hype was all about. So speaking from the perspective of someone who was getting into Mario Paint for the first time, I feel like this set, this achievement set, did a really good job at showing off why this game is so loved. A big thing that's great about Mario Paint is it's not just a drawing tool. You know, it's not just the actual creative components you could do with it, but it's the overall presentation. There are tons of Easter eggs. There's tons of that Nintendo charm all throughout. And I think that the achievement set does a really good job at showcasing that. It makes you go out and seek out all those little secrets, all those Easter eggs. You get to play the fly swatter game. You get to play around on the title screen and see all the little things that happen to Mario. And it's just, it almost reminds me of when I played Mario Maker for the first time, how that game just has that crazy Nintendo level of polish. It's that, but done so many years earlier. And I just think it's really impressive that Nintendo pulled off something like that way back on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, and I think that You kind of got my mind turning a little bit with just, you know, an achievement set that really showcases all of the elements of the game, because that's kind of the feeling that I got with Clay Fighters when I played it as well. So I wanted to talk about the second game that I played this week that also allows, kind of showcases pretty much everything you have to do in the game, because you have to beat it with every single character and you have to do all the difficulty modes. And then there's a couple unique achievements thrown in the mix as well, which is Twisted Metal by Televandalist. It's a vehicular combat game. And I haven't really played a whole lot of vehicular combat games growing up, other than just the battle modes and Mario Kart 64, for example, and like Diddy Kong, but I didn't have a PlayStation growing up. We were Nintendo kids, and so getting to experience Twisted Metal and see what the hype was all about, because people really seem to enjoy the series a lot. I've never talked to anyone that's played them that didn't like them. So playing Twisted Metal was quite a bit of fun, just getting into vehicular combat. And since it is their first iteration of it, I think that the future, like the sequels, are a little bit less janky in terms of the controls, just because some of the cars that you can pick in Twisted Metal are a little bit unbalanced, I guess you would say, as opposed to some of the other ones. So it's just a very unique game in its own right. And it's very short. There's also one achievement that I kind of wanted to highlight, which is having to get into this building without getting into it the standard way, which is, so it's the last level. There's a little pyramid that you can break if you do enough damage to it, and then you can fall into the building. So the achievement is to get into the building without doing it the standard way. So you have to do like this really crazy jump off of another building, and it's like a blind jump of faith. And so that was a very, very unique achievement in the set that kind of made it, gave it a little bit of an interesting twist as opposed to just all of the regular vehicular combat achievements. But overall, the set was a lot of fun, and it showcased quite a bit of the game and what it really has to offer. So I really enjoyed that set a lot.
So I'm very happy you played Twisted Metal, because actually that's a game why I did play when I was a little bit younger, and I just need to find the time to just say like, okay, I'm gonna play some Twisted Metal, because those games are actually pretty damn great. My second game I wanted to talk here is I chose this one for a reason, is I want to bring like people like are not too much familiar with Kaizo, or just maybe like have done learn to Kaizo, and they find, if they want to just find another game where they could just like, okay, this is not too difficult, but like I can't do it. So the one I want to speak is Super Moo World by Vinicius Combat. So why this one is, like I said, is pretty I would not say like very simple, but the stages are quite like not like super long like some Kaizo have. It's pretty short. You have like interesting super mechanic into it, which I maybe never played before, like flip the to going up up to down and down to up and stuff like this. The music into this game is very fantastic. It's very great. You have some little cows running. The graphic is amazing into this game, so the game is well made. And I really want to encourage people who just try to play some Kaizo, and they can just go into this one and have a good time. They have some tough challenges, a little bit some challenges, but in general, the game is made for people to just try it and go for trying some Kaizo. So now I'm gonna let Bendy to talk about this other game.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that one, Draco. I've definitely been wanting to get a little more into Kaizo. I did finish up Learn to Kaizo, like I talked about a few weeks ago on the podcast, and I've been sort of looking for what's the next natural step to continue my Kaizo journey. So, I don't know, maybe I'll do Super Moo World, maybe I'll do something else. I'm definitely keeping my options open, but that one is on my radar for sure. Another game I wanted to talk about that I played recently is Penguin Wars on the Game Boy. This is a set by Sadie. It's also called King of the Zoo in other regions. And it's a really adorable little game. So it's basically, you play as a penguin or as another animal. There's five different animals you can play as. And these little animal friends have come together to play a game. It's some sort of sport that they made up. I don't really know what to call it, but it's basically you stand on opposite sides of the court and you're throwing balls at the opposite side of the court. So at the beginning of a match, you each have five balls on your side of the court and you're throwing balls toward your opponent. And your goal is to get all 10 balls on the opposite side of the court. Very simple concept for a very simple system. It works super well. It's a lot of fun because, I don't know, it's just one of those games that takes a simple concept and rolls with it. And of course, you could hit your opponent to knock them unconscious, so that's where a lot of the strategy comes from. You're not just chucking balls aimlessly, although, let's be real, a lot of my strategy was just chucking balls aimlessly. I did have a little bit of trouble with this set, though. For the most part, it was an easy set, but there was one achievement that eluded me. I probably spent more time on this one achievement than the entire rest of the set. And the achievement is for hitting the little devil five times during a bonus game. So let me explain what that means for you guys who haven't played this one. So first of all, you have to get a bonus game. In order to get a bonus game, you have to play a perfect game. After you play a perfect game, you get a bonus game, and there's a 60-second timer, right? But once the timer hits, I forget if it's either 30 seconds or 15. I think it's 15 seconds, if I remember correctly. Once the timer hits a certain threshold, an obstacle appears. It could be the little devil. It could be something else. So you have to cross your fingers and hope you get the little devil. Otherwise, if you don't get the little devil, you have to do another perfect game until you get him. And even if you get the little devil, you have to hit him five times, but you only have 15 seconds on the clock by the time he appears. So it's just one of those achievements where you have to have all these things to line up just to get a shot at it. And even if you get that shot, you might screw it up. And that's what happened to me. I kept getting it and then screwing it up and being like, okay, let's go through a bunch of bonus games again to try to get this guy to appear again. But overall, pretty fun set. I would definitely recommend it.
I'm glad you enjoyed that set, Bendy. I remember playing that set when it first came out, actually, and struggling with that achievement in particular a lot as well. There's like hit the devil, and then there's like hit the disc or something like that five times in the row as well. And you're, like you said, you have to, you know, wait for that to spawn, like it's random, and you have to get a perfect game for that to happen. So I do remember kind of going through a little bit of those RNG hoops to successfully get to do that. So, but cool to see that you enjoyed a Game Boy set. The other game, one of the other games that I got to play this week that I really, really enjoyed was the, and I'm still working on it, is Legend of Banjo-Kazooie, The Jiggies of Time, by Kaiser Lucas. And this game is really, really, really fun. If you love Banjo-Kazooie and you love Ocarina of Time, this hack is amazing. It is basically Banjo-Kazooie, but if all of the maps and areas were Ocarina of Time, all of the music is Ocarina of Time music, but it's done with Banjo-Kazooie sounds. So it's just, it's so tastefully done. There's tons of Easter eggs put in the game. You can tell that the person that made it, I think his name is like Mark Kirko, I believe. The person that made the hack itself put a lot of time into it. And I was just kind of blown away by the amount of detail in the game. And even the writing is really good. It's got like that Banjo-Kazooie-esque humor style to it, but it's set in the world of Ocarina of Time. It's a little bit, I would say, probably a step up as far as, you know, original Banjo-Kazooie in terms of the platforming and things like that. It kind of goes off of the idea that you're familiar with both Banjo-Kazooie and sort of the maps of Ocarina of Time and the story. But if you love both of those games, this is like the perfect game for you. I can't stress that enough. Every new world or level that I've gotten into has been really, really just blows my mind away with the amount of detail every time I get into a new world or a new area. And they took a lot of the one of the cool things that they did is they took a lot of the assets from Banjo-Kazooie and they turned them into like clever things in the Ocarina of Time world. I can't think of any specific references off the top of my head right off the cuff, but there's just a lot of, if you play it, you'll get to see just a lot of the Banjo-Kazooie assets turned into really clever things in the Ocarina of Time world. So it was really interesting to see how they handled that. And I can't say that enough how much I've been enjoying the set. So thank you, Kaiser Lucas, for making that achievement set.
Thank you, Shuzi, for the awesome with the banjo. I mean, when I play Banjo-Kazooie, I never played before, but I really dig the banjo games. And seeing you play this game, since I'm not too enjoy, I mean, I don't love that much Ocarina of Time, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to have a very good time into this one. So I cannot wait to have the time to just play that awesome set by Kaiser Lucas. Another game which I spent a little bit of time, but I'm not finished yet. It's Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 by VTS Teach. So everybody pretty much know Tony Hawk Pro Skating. I mean, the game itself is quite good. You have awesome music to it as well too when you play it. You really like almost like you feel when you do like some awesome trick, you're super happy when you do it. I really enjoy the Pro Skaters. I did play like the N64 and the first one really a lot when I was a kid. I did try the second one, but it didn't have much of success. So I just like put the second one like away. And I was like, in my head, I was like, maybe I'm just like too old to just play some Tony Hawk again, but I pick up the first one and I have a better time this time than I did before. So I'm very happy to have done some progress there. And I would finish this as soon as possible. It's on my radars. So yeah, pretty excited about that. And so Bendy, do you have another game in mind?
I do, yeah. It's time to talk to you guys about a little something called Kangaroo. This is a set on the Atari 2600 by RetroDave82, And man, oh man, I had a hard time with this set. So first of all, the game is fun. It's a good game and it's a good set. I just want to get that out of the way straight off. It's a very primitive platformer. In classic Atari fashion, there's only three levels, three single screen levels. And then after you beat all three, the game loops and it gets a little bit harder. And then it loops again, gets a little harder, and the cycle continues. So this is one of those sets where I don't know if you guys can relate to this experience, but while playing this set, I kept telling myself, this shouldn't be this hard. I shouldn't be having this much trouble with this because it's such an easy concept. There are only three levels. All you're using is just a joystick and one button. It should be so straightforward. And it took me so much longer to master the set than it should have. The achievements that gave me the hardest time were the deathless achievements. So there are achievements for beating all three stages on the first loop without dying. And then there's beating all three stages on the second loop without dying. Same for the third loop. And I think there might be one for the fourth loop. I don't exactly remember at this point. But it's this idea of having to do all three stages in a row in one clean run is like, it should be easy because they're single screen stages and like it's Atari, it's so simple. But man, I don't know how to put into words, which is a great quality for a podcast, am I right? But I do not know how to put into words why I struggled so much with this one. It was one of those moments. It was one of those experiences of, I should be better, but I'm not. This game is making me feel bad at video games. What else do you got for us, Shoot? What have you been playing these days?
Yeah, I just no, it's funny you mentioned that because I feel like that way a lot of the time with Atari games where they're just like super, super simple, but at the same time, I'm just not grasping the concept. So I've definitely shared that experience as well. As far as another game that I played this week that I really enjoyed, I played the Super Mario Land 4. It's an unlicensed game by Super Cool 101. And it's very short. It's five stages. There's like a damageless boss achievement for each stage. And the bosses are really not a problem in that game. It's more just the platforming is quite not Mario-like because it's unlicensed. So the jumping feels very stiff and it is quite unforgiving. There's also like no ability to peek, so you can't like peek around and see a little bit ahead or a little bit down, so you kind of have to take some leaps of faith. There's no fire flower in this game. There's just like Big Mario where you can shoot like mushrooms that go across the ground. And then there's Wing Cap Mario where you can like hover a little bit when you mash A. And also shoot feathers in forward in a diagonal direction. So those are the only two power-ups available in this unlicensed game. It's just like the platforming is, like I said, just very unforgiving. And so it took a little bit of getting used to. It was a fun little quick set to master. And something I had actually checked out in the past very briefly before in my own personal time before there was an achievement set, but I had never gotten to really play through the game and get to really know it. So now I have an intimate knowledge of that game, whether I like it or not. Just struggling with some of the stages. The stage two is particularly bad as far as difficulty and just how unforgiving it is. So overall, really, really fun, short little set and enjoyed it quite a bit and got to experience more Game Boy goodness. So that's always always a big positive. So kick it over to Draco for his next game.
So yeah, that was very interesting to see you playing that game because you said a Mario game, which is not a Mario game. But I still like the feathers action as well. But I feel like, yeah, the platforming into that one was pretty damn hard because I saw that give you a pretty hard moment there. So speaking of hard moment there, my last game I want to talk about is Colleen McRae Rally 2.0. So this is the second one, because we got a new set, but the first one, but I played the second one first by Vault. So it's a racing game where also like speaking of racing, I like racing game, like people know at this point, but I was like, okay, maybe I managed to do it. I mean, it's rally. I don't know, like maybe I'm okay at drifting, who knows? So I did make probably like, you have two levels you can play. You can play intermediaries, which is like pretty much like normal difficulty, or you can play hard. I got the insane hard time to just play the first difficulty, to be honest. Even if I think I took like maybe like 30 minutes, 40 minutes to just like have a good grip to the controls and stuff. And I passed probably like the two first region or the first two tournament without too much doing some retries and stuff. But when I arrived to the asphalt or the like on the road, that was pretty more tough than I expected as a game. And so it's like it's pretty like you the game is the track could be like what a minute, 40 seconds, 15 seconds, like a segment of the track, and they always say like go left, go right, and you don't see like the road like very far ahead of you. Sometimes it can be like snowy, you can have some rain into the stuff. So you have always like a detail or a twist where you don't expect to see. Sometimes it's the dark. When you have like your little light and it's the dark, you need to memorize your track or your segment, because oh my god, this is pretty challenging. And the road is like pretty like small, so you don't have a lot of margin errors, and a little detail or a little like off track, you pretty much losing your run. So you have to reset in order to just keep winning and stuff. And an interesting factor about this little game I found was every time you finish a segment, you need to repair your cards, and the more damage you take, the less performant your car would be. So that was pretty interesting. So you need to drive very, very carefully and fast at the same time. So that was a pretty challenging aspect to that one. So Bendy, do you have another game in mind?
I do, yeah. Before I get to that, let me just say, I know how good you are at racing games, Draco. So if you're saying you had a hard time with that game, then I fully believe that must be a pretty challenging one. But another game I wanted to talk about is Mega Mania on the Atari 2600 by Sporytyke. I really liked this one. This is a really fun game. So I feel like on the Atari, after the success of Space Invaders, there were so many games that were trying to do that sort of space shooter genre, and to varying levels of success, right? And I feel like Mega Mania is probably one of the better ones. Here's what I like about this game. First of all, it's really fast-paced. The movements of the enemy waves, like the enemies as they move across the top of the screen, they're moving pretty fast. It's not like something like Space Invaders where they just sort of chill there and barely move. That's they have pretty dynamic movement patterns. And the game really encourages aggressive play, I feel. So one of the gameplay mechanics is there's a time limit for each level represented by how much fuel you have for your ship, which is gradually depleting. And the faster you complete the level, you get additional points for how much fuel you had remaining at the end of the wave. And the reason this is important is because after you pass certain point thresholds, you get one-ups, you get extra lives. So it ends up becoming this game where you want to play aggressively because you want to beat the levels quickly, because you want to get more lives, because getting more lives lets you get to later levels, later waves, and it's just a ton of fun. One more thing I wanted to mention about this game that's just a really weird quirk that it has is the way that the shooting mechanic works. So your ship is always at the bottom of the screen. You can only move left or right. You can't move up or down. But when you shoot a laser forward, how do I even explain this? So when you shoot your bullet, if you continue moving left or right, the bullet will also move left or right. The bullet will always be vertically aligned with your ship. So that also ties into what I was saying about how the game encourages aggressive play, right? Because if you want to shoot your opponent, you're going to need to be directly beneath them. But if you're directly beneath them, you're also directly in their line of fire. So it's a risk versus reward thing where it's like dodge. If you're focusing on dodging all the time, then you'll never hit your opponent because your bullet is always perfectly above you, if that makes sense. So I don't know if it was a programming limitation or if it was a conscious choice, but whatever it is, that mechanic gives this a really unique feel compared to similar games, and I feel like for that reason alone, it's worth playing. It's a really fun time. How about you, Shoot? Did you play anything else this week that you'd like to share?
Yeah, last one for the week that I played was Gauntlet Legends, and I'm still working on that. I just got a little bit caught up in the Banjo-Kazooie Ocarina of Time mashup, and that kind of took away some of my attention from the other set I was enjoying, which is Gauntlet Legends by Mopane85. I played a couple of his sets and always really enjoyed the titles that he releases, and this is no exception in that regard. Gauntlet Legends and me have a little bit of a history. I grew up and played Gauntlet Legends in the arcade. I forgot to mention the system it's on. It's on it's the N64 version of the game. But I grew up playing Gauntlet Legends in the arcade with friends, and really, really fun game growing up. Played a lot of it. I played the PlayStation 2 version, Dark Legacy, with my roommate, and we played that game a lot, unlocked like every single character, did all of the challenges, and Gauntlet series in general has always just been a really enjoyable series. There's definitely a grinding aspect to it, but I don't mind it in any way, shape, or form because I'm always having fun while I do it. It's just basically kind of like a hack and slash type of game where you pick, you know, the type of person you want, the archetype, like wizard, warrior, archer, and so on and so forth. And then you just go through the different levels, collect different items in order to progress. Each world has like a hub, and you have to kill a bunch of enemies along the way that spawn in like these nest things that keep generating them. So you just kill the nests, kill enemies, gain experience. You can like buy items before going into levels, and then you have stats. So it's got all of the notable things of like a kind of a RPG hack and slash type of game. But overall, I have quite a bit of progress to make with this set. I haven't gotten too far into it. I just know that this is one that I will probably be trying to get a full completion on, because it's just such an iconic game, and I've really never gotten to experience the full Gauntlet Legends experience all at once. So I think that it'll be a lot of fun to make my way through it and eventually master it. But yeah, I think that's the last game that I had for the week. So kick it over to Draco to hear his thoughts on what we'll be talking about next.
Thank you, Shoot. I just want to say, like, thank you, Shoot Z and Bendy Human, for your game to share this week. Those games are fantastic. I hope all the viewers who are listening to this will give it a try, because I think we came up with some good games this week. So let's kick in with the another segment, so the genre segments. So this week, we're going to talk about the fighting games. So I'm very interested, or maybe people don't know, Shuzi, do you want to give us, to the viewers, what is like a definition of a fighting games in general?
So, you know, when we're talking about fighting games, at least from a retro achievements aspect, you know, there's a lot of things to consider, and also things just to consider in general in fighting games. Is one of the things that always comes to mind that I've asked you with racing games, because that is your area of expertise, but what is the best what is the best general strategy across all fighting games? What are things that are mutually translatable that work well in many different fighting games? You know, obviously it's going to be different when you're fighting a human AI and you're just, you know, sitting down with your friends versus fighting the computer and looking for ways to take advantage of the computer's weaknesses. And I will start this segment off by saying that in general, I am not by any means, I wouldn't consider myself an expert in fighting games. I would say I'm probably intermediate at best, but one thing that I would say I'm pretty good at is figuring out what does the computer not like that I can take advantage of. And in retro games, that seems to be something that you're always going to be able to find, you know, a meta comp or something where the computer just doesn't like X, Y, or Z mechanic, and then you just take advantage of that mechanic as much as you can. So that's one thing that I've always tried to focus on when I'm learning a fighting game and trying to get good at it.
You know, I'm thinking about this idea we're bringing up about cheesing the AI in fighting games, right? So just speaking from personal experience, I haven't played a ton of fighting games. I probably have the least experience with fighting games of the three of us. But when I do play a fighting game, I tend to very quickly get overwhelmed by all the buttons, all the combos, all just the general learning curve. It's a genre that's kind of difficult for me to get into. But if there's one thing I'm good at, it's cheesing AI. When I play a fighting game, I feel like it's kind of a problem that I have. I think the reason I struggle so much with fighting games is because I've never sat down and made the effort to actually learn how to play the game properly. Instead, I've made the effort to learn how to win. And the way you win against, if you could beat an AI, that doesn't necessarily mean you're good at the game. That means you're good at exploiting the AI, right? To give you an example, when I was a kid, I remember playing Super Smash Bros. Melee, and I thought I was amazing at that game when I played it by myself because I was really good at beating the AI. Turns out, if you know what to do, the AI is really, really easy to exploit, even on the higher difficulties. And then as I grew older and I started playing the game with friends, I rapidly realized, oh, I'm not actually good at Smash. I know Smash is kind of not the best example because it's kind of more of a party game than a traditional fighting game. But I feel like that pattern has carried across fighting games for me in general, where I play it by myself, and I figure out how to cheese the AI, and I'm like, I'm so good at this game. I got a great strategy. And then I play it with a friend, and suddenly my amazing strategy doesn't work anymore. Suddenly I realize I never learned how to play the game. I'm not as good at this game as I thought I was.
Yeah, and I think you do make a good point there that, you know, when you're playing against the AI and you know how predictable the AI can be on older fighting games, then it kind of becomes, you know, not as difficult. Whereas humans are a little bit more randomized in the way that they think and the way that they do things. And so, you know, I never forget as a kid, with some fighting games you play, you just have the friend that would just do the projectile spam, or the friend that would do you know, that one move spam over and over again. And you may see similar patterns in AI at times, but not to the level of humans a lot of the time on like projectile spam or ability spam. And you have to understand how to deal with that. You know, you have to, like, when you're playing against people, have to come up with unique ways to counter their cheese with your own cheese mechanic a lot of the time and just cancel each other out. So that is a really good point that you bring up, where you're by yourself and you feel like you're the best in the world at the game, you know, or not maybe the best in the world, but you're pretty good at it. And then you play against your friends and you get your butt kicked and you're like, oh, okay, well, maybe I need to work on my game a little bit more than I thought.
The fighting game for me, I mean, like people know a lot, I'm not the greatest at all at fighting games. So for me, fighting games are always something I dodge when I play, but it's a little bit different. Here's a good example here. The only game I played, like Benny mentioned, was pretty much like Melee, like the 64 one as well. And I play a little bit of Ultimate, other stuff. I like when you play like a fighting games where you can have like one button do something. Example, like A, do jumps. You can do projectile into one button. You can play other fighting games. Like we play some Marvel versus Capcom. We have one button do a specials and other stuff like this. If you go into like more specific, like combo heavy, like left, right, B, A, stuff like this, I will be like the worst of the worst because I actually don't know how, I will never learn how to, what button would do. Normally the time what I was going to do, I'm just going to try to mash every single button because I'm so used to the control of like example like I said Melee, which I just spam button and do something. I'm not to the moon where I would like if I do this it would do that. So for me fighting games is always quite tough, and most of the time if they have like combo heavy or something like that, I'll probably most like I'm almost gonna give up on them, except if they have like a special button unique to them or something, or an attack special, which is very easy to find. So,
yeah, and a lot of fighting games to that point do have it where, you know, they'll have light kick, medium kick, and heavy kick, or light punch, medium punch, and heavy punch all as separate buttons. But then they'll also have a button where it combines all three of them, and it works really well because, you know, you'll have something where you'll have to do like quarter circle forward plus two types of punches, and you can just do quarter circle forward and then hit the one button versus have to hit the two buttons, like you said. It really just depends on the game itself. But I think to that point as well, you know, when I am playing fighting games on Retro Achievements, one of my favorite things, types of achievements rather, while it can be frustrating, is achievements where you have to pull off some type of special combo or unique move. You know, I can think back to like playing Marvel versus Capcom and having to pull off like Shadow Lady's final mission, I think is what it's called. It's like a kind of a complex combo. So doing some of these complex combos and putting the time in and then like getting it, you know, if it takes you a couple hours, is always a really satisfying feeling to pull off. And it's weird because it just seems so simple to do a button combination, but it's all about timing and it's all about muscle memory. And those are some of the achievements I struggle with the most. A lot of the time is nailing down like a really, really specific combo. Cause like I said, I'm okay at fighting games, but I'm not necessarily the fastest fingers in the West. So it's just like, those are some of my favorite achievements, is getting big hit combo achievements and having that mastery of that particular element of the game, or just like nailing that specific combo that that triggers that special ability that's really important. So
I think on the topic of these big, long, crazy combos, it's one of the things that really sets fighting games apart from other genres. Because if you think about it, fighting games require you to do types of inputs that really no other game requires you to do. Things like quarter circles. And what other game are you going to have to do a quarter circle? And what other game are you going to have to press this elaborate series of buttons in this exact order to pull off this combo? It really is a genre that has a kind of unique control scheme in comparison to a lot of the other stuff out there, which I feel like, depending on the individual, can either be why you love fighting games or why you hate fighting games. I will say this, though. I feel like fighting games are one of those genres where the skills you gain from one game are very transferable to other games in the genre. If you've played a lot of fighting games, you could pick up some fighting game you've never played before, and you'll probably figure it out a lot quicker than someone who doesn't have that experience with those style of inputs. And I think that's why so many people tend to just resort to button mashing, is because they haven't really trained their brain to this new style of inputs that they haven't experienced before. It really is sort of a learning process. And I think as a genre as a whole, it's a bit of a learning curve to get into, right? And I feel like that can be intimidating for a lot of people.
You made a very interesting point here, Bendy, because when you speak about like a lot of button, like this genre, like is more about like you need to know your button almost and try to find the best button sequence to have a good attack. If I compare this like almost to racing game is like you have probably like one button for the item if they have items, a drift buttons. You just like left and right, and you just need to tap a little bit your joystick or your D-pad to make like some drift or some controls, which is pretty like significant difference than if I'm playing fighting games. And a lot of the fight game I did played, it's not because sometime like you have like one, like this for me, like the screen is a little bit like small, or the game is a little small, and the AI mash so hard the combo, like the combo button they have, and they know like the game like crazy. And sometimes you feel like the AI is way too good. Even if you know your button very well, the AI is so high and they almost like cheat every single time. They predict you like crazy and they always combo you to death. So I have a lot of situation where I play a fighting game, and I just like insta die. And my only objective was trying to like doing a little bit like a movement or like a certain move, but I didn't have any time frame to do it because the AI was so on me or so hard on me, or I didn't have the space. So this is why most of the time I prefer to having one button do something, because into those situations, you're just almost panicking at yourself there. So do you have like any moment where you feel the AI was really like not cheating on you, but I mean like very hard, and you have a hard time dealing with some fighting games?
Yeah, I think you bring up a pretty good point. You know, a lot of the time that I am doing fighting games, there is that frustrating thing of like the achievements to do this special or whatever. And not only do you have to have like two or three of your super meter, but you have to like not get interrupted, right? So it can always be kind of a frustrating thing where you're trying to get off a specific combo, and like, you know, a lot of the time for the achievement, practice mode isn't allowed. You have to get it in a real-time fight against the computer. And I think there's kind of, while that is frustrating, you know, that's like, that's one of the things that I'm so entertained by about fighting games, is just like that brutalness of having to really think on the fly and be able to be really calculated about when you time certain moves so that you don't find yourself in those situations. And that kind of makes me think of, you know, some of the end bosses for fighting games can just be extremely, extremely brutal. You know, they either do more damage, they just spam abilities at times, or, you know, with SNK games in particular, like SNK arcade games, the final boss for fighting games is just like really, really brutal. Like they match your movement. So based on your distance to them, they'll do this or that. If you try and jump into them, they'll do like a uppercut or an anti-air ability. There are really, really tough final bosses for a lot of the fighting games. So you always have to kind of just like figure out ways to work around the AI, which is one of my favorite parts of kind of breaking down a fighting game, is trying to, you know, figure out again what does the computer really, really not like that I can take advantage of and use to my advantage? So one of the things I can think of off the cuff that I try with a lot of fighting games that I do play is older fighting games, AI is really bad a lot of the time against low kicks for whatever reason. Maybe it's because when they program the game, they kind of just keep the standard level in mind of, you know, both fighters not being crouched. They probably put maybe less time into what the computer's going to do reacting to the other player being in a crouch position. I'm not really sure, but that's an example of something that I always try just to see how the AI is going to react to me when I do moves in my crouched form. So, yeah.
I feel like when we play fighting games on retro achievements, it's maybe a different experience than when we played fighting games as a kid, right? Because as a kid, fighting games are like, well, you play them by yourself just when you don't have friends over, but they're really about the multiplayer experience. Whereas with retro achievements, it's like, okay, the goal isn't to play with friends. The goal is to really overcome this insanely difficult AI. And like you said, especially final bosses a lot of the time, in SNK games in particular, they just go crazy overboard with the boss difficulty. I don't know the reasoning for it. Maybe it has something to do with a lot of fighting games have arcade origins and they were designed to eat up your quarters. But for whatever reason, yeah, they don't make it easy to get to the end. I feel like when you're a kid, or at least when I was a kid, I would always sort of give up at that point because I was like, well, you're not supposed to beat this. This is just unreasonable. And I was never really motivated to try that hard to beat it as a kid because I felt like, well, this isn't why I bought this game. This isn't the fun part of the game. The fun part is playing with friends, right? Whereas with retro achievements, it really changes your perspective on how you approach these games, where now it's like, well, no, actually, this is the point of the game. The point of the game is to master the game. If you want to be a master at this fighting game, you have to beat this ridiculously overpowered boss by any means necessary. And a lot of the time, you really do have to pull out just about every trick in the book to secure that W.
So I would like to ask you, both of you, Shuzi and Bindiyun, before we go into the last, the other segment we have. So what is for you the best or worst fighting game you have played and why? So for me, I would say like for the worst fighting game I played, I think I would say like pretty much every single fighting game, which are pretty like, rather like the AI is pretty much like super hard to beat. And you need to know very well the game because I'm not the, like I said, mentioned a lot of time, I'm not the, I like when you play fighting game, it's almost like fair, like 50-50, where if you do like certain stuff, you can have a chance at least to win. And sometimes when I play some fighting games, I always feel it's rather I don't do enough damage. Like imagine like when you're pressing a button or a punch or a kick, and you just do a slight bit of damage, but the AI like use a combo and do like 3/4 or a half of your HP and you're most pretty much done. So for me, every single of those kind of type of fightings, I'm not a fan of, to be honest, but for me, I think I will stick with my best. The best of the best will always for me be melees or Ultimate or Brawls or any type of Mario, Super Smash Bros. Stuff like that, not Super Smash Bros. Those fighting games, because those are like, you choose a class, you just your characters, you just can play with item or not. You have a stage, it's not complicated. One button do some damage, you can recover or not. For me, this is one of the fighting games I've changed pretty much like the way I see fightings more than other indie games. I try to tend to check out, like I did play some Marvel vs. Capcom. I do try to increase my skills into other ways to approaching the fighting game genres. But for me, I always stick with my melees and stuff because those are the most, I would say like easiest to learn pickups and stuff without very be like frustrated about playing games and just quit or leave because the game is require too much of button memorization or skills involved. So I'm very curious to see what are you two think about this question.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think for me, I would say hand over fist, Marvel versus Capcom, or Marvel Super Heroes versus Street Fighter. Those type of games are my favorite because there's so much advantages that you can stack as far as like what you're able to do against the computer that I feel like I have such a great toolkit to work with. And I feel like for me personally, they are fighting games, but there is a lot of strategy that goes into, you know, like, okay, I have, you know, I have almost a full two super, but I've got, I've got one super almost filling to two. At two, I can cast this ult because it costs two super. So I'm going to do that. And then as soon as I'm done casting that, I'm going to follow up with this. Like, I don't know, time just, maybe it's a weird thing for me, but like time just slows down in fighting games. And I feel like I can calculate all these things ahead of time with the Marvel versus Capcom style game where there's just so much different stuff flying everywhere. There's a couple more sets that are very similar, have that kind of vibe. Like I haven't done X-Men versus Street Fighter yet, so I'm planning to do that one at some point. And then if we do get a Dreamcast system here in the future, you know, if someone does a Marvel versus Capcom 2, I would be all over it. But I think that's my favorite kind of game just because I feel like it's fighting, but there's just so much strategy and there's so many different things you can do and combinations, especially with like tag team style fighting that you can do that just give it such a great variance and make it a lot of fun. And I think for least favorite, it would probably just be probably just like your most basic fighters. I mean, I've played the Mortal Kombat games for Game Boy and they're just so simple and like it's got nothing to do with the achievement sets, obviously. It's just the games themselves are so like, you know, it's Mortal Kombat franchise. They're porting it to as many systems as possible. So like they just feel so basic in terms of like the gameplay that it almost does feel a little bit like luck at times with games like that, you know, really dumbed down games that are bad ports. But even then, you know, you can figure out some cheese and things like that. So that would probably be my favorite type of game and my least favorite type of game for fighting. What about you, Bendy?
I think for my least favorite, it's hard to pick a single game that encompasses this idea, but all of my least favorite fighting games have this in common. My least favorite fighting games tend to be those really early 3D fighting games, because I feel like in the 2D era, we had some pretty solid games, right? We had the Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and all that good stuff. And then as we transition to 3D, fighting games are one of those genres that really seem to suffer, where a lot of them tried to think, oh, let's add this mechanic where you can move around in 3D space, and it just doesn't work well. And a lot of the times the models look like garbage. It loses the flash and the flare that make fighting games so good. And just a lot of the times the controls are so dang clunky and stiff. And so it's hard for me to choose just one game that embodies this idea. But basically just any of those really early like PS1 fighting games, they all kind of blend together in my head because they all just, they fall into those same pitfalls. As far as my favorite, I'm going to give a kind of unconventional answer here, but you guys know that I'm a filthy casual, right? My biggest problem with fighting games is I get overwhelmed by all the buttons and stuff. And there's a fighting game called the Dive Kick. It's not retro, it's on Steam. And it basically distills the concept of the fighting game into the simplest terms possible. It's a two-button fighting game. It doesn't use the D-pad, it literally uses two buttons, and that's it. which sounds like way too simple to be a game, but for some reason it works so well. It makes it so I don't have to think so hard about the buttons and how to do everything, which is what usually gets me caught up in fighting games. I get kind of overwhelmed keeping track of all the buttons and combos and stuff. This keeps things super, super simple, so you can get to the fun part of fighting games, where it's almost like a chess match, where you're doing these mind games with the opponent. You're trying to predict what they're going to do next. You're trying to fake them out. That's the idea that makes fighting games so fun. It's just usually there's such a learning curve to get to that point. And this is a game that lets you get to that point quickly and jump straight to the mind games. And it is a ton of fun to play with games, a ton of fun to play with friends. Would definitely recommend that one. So I think we are probably about ready to move on to our next segment. Would you like to go ahead and get us started on that, Draco?
Thank you, Bendy. First of all, like, very interesting thought, both of you, into that question. Thank you for that. And one thing I want to say is I'm very curious to see as well how the people are watching this video, what they think about, what is their favorite fighting game as well or worse. So make sure to leave us a comment down below the video and share a thought with us. So the other segment I want to bring is pretty much like the guides. So the motive of using guides. So, Bendy, can you give us a little like definition of what is this all about?
So, when I think about guides, guides come in many forms, right? The first one that comes to mind for me anyway is you look up a text-based walkthrough on something like GameFAQs, and you get stuck in a game and you think, oh, I need to look up what to do. You look up a text-based walkthrough, it tells you what to do, and then you continue the game. But really, guides come in so many different forms. There's video guides on YouTube. In fact, these days, a lot of people prefer those over text-based guides. I'm more of a traditionalist. I like the text-based guides personally. And then there's also strategy guides, like the physical paper strategy guides. So there's all of these different types of guides, but I feel like they all fall under the umbrella of guides. And then there's sort of even more strict definitions depending on who you ask. Like, some people would say that any information found outside of the game is a guide. Like, if you're just talking to people on an online forum, is that a guide? If you're just talking to your friends about a game, is that technically a guide? They're giving you information you didn't get from the game. So it's a very open-ended topic, right? But I think what it boils down to is games can be pretty hard. And sometimes we need a little bit extra help. But Draco, I see you're itching to say something, so I'll throw it over to you. Let's see what your thoughts are.
Yes. So, about this subject, this is pretty, I would say, like a hard subject. But like my thoughts about those guide or slash people help you, because like when I'm playing a game, some people like just here to want to chat and they give me some information which I probably never know about a game, which I never played before. So this is always hard to deal with, I would say. So for me, I am very a guy where when I play any type of video games, any games, if I have like a struggle or I feel like, okay, I'm lost there or I need an information to moving on. So rather my nerve tell me like I'm very, sometimes I could be very impatient with myself. So for me, it's like, okay, I need to clear this, but I don't know how. They have like a way, and sometimes I did spend more than an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to finding a path because I am sometimes stubborn and I don't want to look it up. But at the same time, I want to moving on. And I'm very, every time I would just want to moving up. So I'm very, like, most of the time, I'm very a visual guy who learned by visual. So rather than reading what I need to do, I tend to looking up into maybe someone play the level I am or the situation I am in, and I'm just copy what he do. So for me, it's like a tools where I can just like, okay, for just little part I'm struggling with, I can just moving on, and then I don't need to look for the rest. So for moving on into the game, I don't feel necessarily bad to just using it because I never play the game. Or sometimes when I'm using a little bit of guide where we just the topic we just had, the fighting games. I mean, I never played the game before. I'm not the greatest player at fighting games. How I supposed to know if you do left, right, A, B, we do a mega kick and you almost install like half damage the enemy you do. How I supposed to know that? I have no idea. So sometimes when you use those guideline to guide you into it, it's very like crucial to give you information and to make having maybe a better time into it. So I'm very curious to see what you think about that, guys.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those topics where there is so much to unpack and unravel here. But I wanted to start off my thoughts by expanding a little bit on something you brought up, Draco. You brought up the idea of sometimes you'll be playing a game on stream and people in your chat will be, you know, talking about the game, and that sort of gives you outside information on the game and you might learn some things that you didn't know otherwise. And it got me thinking about this idea of, should you go into how much outside information do you want when you're going into a game for the first time? I usually try to stick with the mentality of, if I'm playing a game for the first time, I want to go in blind, and then I could look stuff up later if it comes to that point. But at the same time, I feel like certain games sort of punish you for doing that sort of thing. For example, on retro achievements, we have a number of sets that have missable achievements. So when a set has missables, I feel like I have to do research before I even start the set, right? So in that case, before I've even played the game, I'm already looking up guides in order to save myself time. And I think a lot of games fall into that trap where, especially with RPGs, it seems, a lot of RPGs are like, if you do this early on, you'll regret it later. But you'll only know that you weren't supposed to do this early on if you had information that you would never know if you were just playing the game for the first time blind, right? So it's this really interesting dynamic of, on one hand, I know that the game designers designed this game with a certain experience in mind. They don't expect you to know the ins and outs your first time playing. But I feel like a lot of games kind of have these design pitfalls where it sort of screws you over and punishes you in a sense. It makes you wish, well, I wish I had looked up a guide if I knew I was going to have to go through all that. Now I regret not looking up a guide, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely can see where you guys are coming from based on what you've said, because it kind of depends a little bit on the game's genre and then how I feel towards the game. So to give an example on that, like fighting games, there's no way I'm going to like figure out so-and-so's like finisher move just by pressing buttons like over and over again. Fighting games, you know, coming back to that a little bit, like I always look up a full move list. Like I just need to know, like I need to start practicing the moves, figuring out what's good, figuring out what's not good, and getting my feet wet with that. On the completely inverse side of that, a game that I talked about this week that I'm getting into, the Banjo-Kazooie Jiggies of Time mashup. I have such a passion for Banjo-Kazooie and Ocarina of Time, and it's like a collectathon style game. And so I'm kind of challenging myself to look up as little as possible, only if I'm spending, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours looking for one specific item and it's not time efficient, I'll, you know, look up a video of what to do. But so that's kind of the complete opposite, where I feel like very little obligation to look up a guide. I can proceed through the game, you know, without issue. And without having to really look a whole lot up, but pretty much all the achievements are collection based. So it's something where I want to make sure that, you know, I'm not missing anything, and also that I'm not spending too much time on anything. But that's kind of one of those situations where, like with what Draco was saying, if I don't have to look it up, I like to go in and, you know, try and figure out as much as I can. But on the flip side, with like a fighting game, it only really makes sense to look up the moves if there's not a command list, because it's just the most efficient way to play the game, still have fun, because you still have to do that correct input every time with a fighting game, but at the same time, make sure that you actually know a little bit about the game. So there is kind of that weird like balance of the type of game, how you feel about the game, and then how the achievements mix into those two, right?
I really like the idea of like doing game blind, because in like some of mini games I will play, like example a racing game, I don't really need tools of a guide to help me how playing a racing game. I mean, you have your acceleration button, your brake button, your drift button and stuff like this. It's always the same stuff. But into like the operating of what Shoot and Betty mentioned, like RPGs and missables are really a big thing. If I play like a game without playing on retro achievement example, I would not worry about if I collect every single aspect too. But if you have into the upper hand a set where you have to collect stuff and you make sure to not screw them up and missables, like a good example, like I would mention like the Professor Layton, which I did play it. I mean, if I did not look it up for every single coins, or maybe if I was a maniac and tapping into the screen for every single little details as possible and spending maybe 5-10 minutes to just make sure I tap everything, I will be all right. But imagine if you play like a game where like later and you play like for 10, 20, 30, 40 hours into the game already, and you just did one mistake and you need to do the entire game again just because you didn't want it to go with like a little tools to help you out. So a lot of the times a guide is very useful in some ways in my mind, where you can add an extra like safety to you. So another good example I want to mention here is speedrunning. So why speedrunning and guides? I mean, to be honest, like look this way. You speedrun Pokemon games, you speedrun any type of game where you can route everything on. So if you have something like, okay, this map is, you can see the map, the tools or the guide, like the maps is like this. Okay, you can maybe like in your head memorize a pattern you want to take on. Oh, this place have an item I never take before. So like Pokemon is pretty good to, if you want to plan and route, rather than playing the game and route, both way works. You can like have like make a document of yourself with your own notes. So those type of tools, guide and slash, are pretty useful for people who want to maybe learn a new games or route the games or stuff like this. So yeah. So I think Bendy wanted to mention something. So let's go into Bendy.
Thanks, Draco. So a thought I had is, I feel like when I play a game and I get stuck in a game, right, I'm always gradually reaching this breaking point, where the breaking point is what I define as the point in which I turn to a guide. And I think a really interesting dynamic of gaming and retro gaming, retro achievements, all that, is finding out where your breaking point is. Because when I get stuck in a game, there's a couple different outcomes when I look up a guide, right? One outcome is I look up a guide and I realize, oh, that actually, I probably could have figured that out if I had spent more time on the puzzle or whatever I was stuck on. And that's a terrible feeling, because when I do that, it feels like I cheated. It feels like I don't get the same mental satisfaction of overcoming a tough puzzle or a tough boss or whatever it may be. But then there's the other side of the coin. Sometimes I'm stuck in a game for a long time. I look up a guide, and then the solution is so obscure, so esoteric, that I have this overwhelming thought of, Well, that was stupid. I never would have figured that out. I wish I would have looked up a guide even sooner. So it's this balancing act of do I chance looking up a guide, or do I stick with it in the hopes that I figure it out? Or do I look up a guide because the solution is probably something stupid? And it's, I think that everyone has a different breaking point, right? And I think that's a really interesting topic we could talk about, is how far will you go before you reach that point where it's like, okay, it's guide time.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great way to put it, Bendy, is like, what is your breaking point as far as like when you're going to look something up versus, you know, when you're not? And I go through the very similar range of emotions with that as far as, you know, like feeling like cheated out of the experience of figuring it out versus that feeling of like, yep, I never would have figured this out. Like, I just would never have figured it out. So I'm glad that I did look it up. And, you know, obviously, with the site, it's important to maintain that fun factor and to enjoy the game in the way that's the most fun for you. And so everybody does have that different breaking point. And I have had some moments of disappointment where I'm just like, man, I really wish I hadn't looked that up because I would have figured that out. But I've also had those other moments where I'm just like, yeah, I wouldn't have. So there is really that fine line. And sometimes you end up being really happy about not crossing it, and you feel really accomplished about what you were able to figure out in the game, and you surprise yourself. And, you know, there's also games where there's like little hints kind of built into the game that you guys talked about a little bit. There was kind of that experience this week with Banjo-Kazooie, Jiggies of Time, where there's like a lot of like built-in hints that are just kind of pushing you in the right direction, but not totally giving it away. So that's one of the things that really made that quite an enjoyable game. And still had to look up a couple things that here and there as I'm going through it, but it's kind of like the perfect balance for me personally, at least.
So I got like a final thought about this this guide and stuff. I mean, so we have two different ways to see it, okay? You have one player's into one side who will play a game, a normal game or like any game, and they're just gonna find the information they need, like I said, like earlier, speedrunners, information where, example, like RPG, and you don't know how to do this quest or what triggered this quest, and you're just gonna look it up. And you have the upper hand where probably like I'm not into this kind of like, I mean, I'm not this type of like want to go that side, but it's like you can play like some game with just the entire game with just a guide, and you just look the entire way. So this is not what I personally like to play on a game. I really like to using those tools, info tools, when I really need to, and most of the time is RPG. So I have a last question for you, both of you, is like, what is the type of games of you prefer to use a guide on? And you feel that, like, which genres are, like, the better scenario for both of you? You prefer, like, okay, I mean, yeah, this is a little bit too much difficult. So I think for me would probably most be, like, if I have to do a quest or something with a very big quest, or you need to talk to 50 NPC or 10 NPCs and stuff like this, or you're lost into one point, you just help you out and succeed it. So I'm very curious to see what you both think about this one.
I feel like as I've grown older, my patience has grown thin in games that waste your time. And I think a lot of retro games, especially retro RPGs, kind of have a tendency to waste your time. Like, don't get me wrong, I love old school turn-based RPGs, but like, if we look at something like some of the old Final Fantasies or Dragon Quests, sometimes it's not really clear where you're supposed to go next, or, oh, you didn't talk to that one NPC at that one to get the story trigger so that the next thing can happen. And like, there's just little things like that. Oh, you didn't stand in the middle of this field and use this item. And to trigger this dungeon to appear. Things like that are that things that I have very little patience for. And I get it. These games are designed for when you're a kid in the 80s or whatever, and you have all the time in the world to just play the game. But in moments like that, I really don't feel any guilt or shame in looking up a guide. Other situations where I may look up a guide are for things like retro achievement specific challenges. Like, for example, if I'm trying to beat a boss without taking damage, a lot of the time I find guides pretty helpful with that because I'm not the best at parsing boss patterns and figuring out the best ways to dodge attacks. I don't feel bad using a guide when the challenge is in the execution, right? If I'm doing something like a damageless boss, the guide is going to help make it easier for me. But even then, the actual execution is the challenging part. I feel like I'm the most resistant to using guides in something like a puzzle game, where it's like there's a solution, you either know it or you don't. Because if you look up a guide, it ruins the puzzle. It ruins that feeling of discovery. But an interesting mechanic that some games have is they'll have built-in features within the game that are sort of like a guide. I think a pretty good example is the hint coins in the Professor Layton games. So if you get stuck on a puzzle, you don't necessarily have to go online and look up a walkthrough. You could spend a hint coin, and then you could get a level 1 hint, or a level 2 hint, or a level 3 hint, or in the later games they also have a level 4 hint. And it's basically, it just gives you a little push toward the answer, depending on how much of a push you need. So I like when games do that, when they build guide-like things into the game, but it's optional. It's up to the player whether or not you want to take advantage of those features. At the same time, though, retro achievements tends to not let you use those features. Like, I know for Professor Layton, you're not allowed to spend any hit coins, so if you do use them, you have to reload your save. So again, that's just another one of those examples of how retro achievements can kind of change how we approach games.
Yeah, I think for me personally, I think that games where I really don't mind using the guide, as I mentioned, is fighting games, just because like having a command list, if there's no command list built into the game, is just the best way to approach the set and to like figure out what to do. I think where I'm really most opposed to doing it is definitely, I'm kind of right there with Bendy on puzzle, because puzzle is all about the puzzle and usually not about the execution. I think he put it pretty well. I can't really say it much better, to be honest. It's just, if it's a damage list, for example, but it's like really, I mean, damage list is always typically execution based, unless there's some crazy cheese strat, then that's like, that's always something that I'm thinking about at the end of the day, is like, okay, yeah, I can look it up, but I still have to be able to execute really, really well. So it's not really, there's some time saved in coming up with the strategy, but at the same time, I still have to be able to execute on a high level, and the challenge is still there. And I think it's pretty evident in the way you feel after you get the achievement. If you feel like you really, you feel like you've truly earned the achievement, right? You feel that sense of satisfaction. And I think that sense of satisfaction that we all feel when we get that tough achievement, whether we looked up to do what to do rather or what not to do, is ultimately indicative of how, what the achievement is like and how it feels overall. You know, like I said, if you get the damage list, even if you looked up the strat, if it was really, really execution based, it just feels still satisfying to me to get it. Whereas if I look up something for a puzzle game to solve a puzzle, I just really don't get that feeling at all.
One last thought I wanted to bring up is, I know on retro achievements, there are a lot of games that are really obscure, or there are also situations of games that are well known, but the achievements focus in on really obscure, unknown aspects of those games. And I feel like those sort of situations really push me to use a guide a lot of the time too. I can't tell you, I'm having a hard time coming up with specific examples on the spot, but I can't tell you how many times I've been playing a game on Retro Achievements that was one of my childhood games, and I thought I knew everything that there was to know about the game. And then I looked up one of the achievements on the list and I said, "What's that? I didn't know you could do that. How do you do that?" And it's something so obscure, so, you know, hyper fixated on this obscure mechanic that it kind of pushes you to look up a guide. So in situations like that, I feel like guides are awesome because they really let you experience a game to the fullest. But then I've also had situations where the game or the achievement is so obscure that, like, it's not well documented on the internet and I can't even find help. So I just have to either ask the RA community or figure it out on my own. And like a lot of the time with these unlicensed games, these bootlegs, there's not that much information out there on them, for example, or some of these ROM hacks, for example. And sometimes you either got to figure it out or you have to ask your friends who have played the set. And I think that's just another little interesting twist on this whole how we approach games with or without guides idea.
Yeah, you brought up a couple of things that triggered some thoughts for me as far as that is, you know, I have played a few games like that on Retro Achievements, some Apple II games where the information is very esoteric and there's really not a lot of information on what to do. And so you kind of have to just, you know, put on your big boy pants, so to speak, and just figure it out. There aren't many games like that, you know, with the availability of information on the internet. But if you're playing something really esoteric or something that really wasn't played or for a really, really old system, you might have to go down that road. And it's an interesting road to go down. And there is that like really, really satisfying feeling, I could say, at least in my personal experience, of like, wow, there's nothing on the internet and I still figured this one out. Pretty cool. So I've experienced that a few times and it's a interesting feeling and definitely gives you a lot more of a hype moment than just your usual, okay, I looked this up and it was still execution based. I feel like that's the highest, if we're putting hype moments into tiers, that's like the S tier hype moment when there's no info online and you're still able to figure something out. And then point number two that I thought of really quickly before we wrap things up here is just that, since we've talked about a bunch about fighting games today, one interesting tidbit about some fighting games and some of the more obscure things in the fighting games is that there's a lot of misinformation on the internet about fighting games for certain things like how to unlock this fighter, how to unlock the fight with this fighter, where there's, you know, two or three websites with very conflicting information. And so you have to go through the trial and error process of trying all of them. I've been in that situation multiple times and I don't know about other genres, but for fighting games, that's been an experience of mine that's been frustrating, yet kind of just like this weird, like, do people really not know this stuff in 2020? Is there like no concrete answer? But it's just, you know, over time, this information has been built up and collected on the internet, and no one's ever gone back and rewritten their guide from 2008 when they thought this was the way they did it based on anecdotal evidence. In reality, they didn't know what they did. And so that's also kind of an odd thing that can happen from time to time where there is seemingly good information out there. However, after experimenting and testing, you figure out that that's not quite what it was about. And you have to either come up with your own way to do it or find another source of information that's more credible or reliable. So just another little thought that I had when you brought that up, Bendy, but I'll kick things over to Draco to get things wrapped up here for today.
Yeah, thank you, Shoot, and thank you, Bendy, for all the good thought over here. And I just want to bring a final thought to all the listeners we have, they're going to listen to this video. So in conclusion for the guide segment, I said, like, guides are good tools to help you out if you have some a little bit of difficulty in some games in some ways, but it's always how you're gonna like how to get how you're gonna using it to not like making like too hard on it. So yeah, so I think it's a good way to see some problem, but it's always about how you all using it. So that's wrap things up for today's episode of our podcast. Be sure to like the video and hit the bell to make sure you never miss an episode. Let us know in the comment what your favorite fighting game is and how do you feel about using guides. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy today's episode and hope to see you again soon. Bye!